You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, November 3rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal... No, we're not. No longer broadcasting live in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times, nor are we in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Instead, we've moved over into a new studio in sunny downtown Brooklyn. Obviously, still a work in progress. On the program today, in anticipation of the midterm elections, Cliff Schechter will be with us. Also on the program today, in anticipation of the midterm elections, Becky Bond, president of the Credo Super PAC. And on the program today, the midterm elections. Referendums. And a discussion of the chances of the Democrats holding the Senate. Also on the program today, FCC floating a hybrid version of net neutrality. The IPCC says fossil fuels should be totally phased out by 2100 and mostly gone by 2050. And speaking of fossil fuels, an amazing revelation audio of an energy lobbyist being a total scumbag, or at least I should say, being honest in revealing what a scumbag he and his industry are. And it turns out the federal government closed off airspace above Ferguson, Missouri, at the request of police who didn't want media to see what they were doing. All that and more on today's program. Folks, just briefly, we are partnering with the PCCC. We've got about 24 hours, I guess, left where you can participate in calling out the vote. Go to Majority Report, COTV, for call out the vote. C as in cat. Majority Report, COTV.com. Give you an opportunity to, from the comfort of your own home, or I guess theoretically your work as well, to place phone calls to get the vote out. This is all about turnout, folks. This is a turnout election. It does not look good for the Democrats to retain control of the Senate, and the implications of that are disturbing in and of itself. So if you want to get involved and help out in those states in which you do not live, Majority Report, COTV.com. All right, just a little bit of house cleaning. You know, we're still dealing with, obviously, the move. We are in a sort of a temporary situation here. I know our sound is a little subpar. We're working on that. We have realized that a couple of our machines did not make the journey across the East River in a healthy condition, so we've got to buy a new processor, processor compressor gate. I'm butchering this. Preamp device. So we're also obviously working on trying to get up our Indiegogo campaign to raise a little money to do this properly over here. But so bear with us. We're going to be doing shows at least today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. We'll probably take Thursday as another tech day. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure. Oh, well, you know what? It didn't even occur to me because we're doing this on a Monday. We're breaking. Well, let's save it for Friday because he's going to be back on Friday. We're breaking format because, of course, we had some type of huge, massive technical failure on Friday wherein apparently people reported getting some type of right-wing show in our stead. But as we are just a day away from it's not really the beginning of the voting because it's voting has already started to take place around the country, but a day away from what may very well be the end of the voting of the midterm elections, joining us is the great Cliff Schechter. Hello, Cliff.
Why, hello, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It doesn't look good for the Democrats' retention of the Senate. But one never knows, does one?
One does never know. I often like to point out things to people that one cannot predict, nor, you know, really never can predict. I mean, you know, there's, I hate to get all, you know, historical on people's asses, but maybe I have to do that, which is, you know, there was a point in 1992 where I remember it, a young college student I was back then, Sam. Where that guy named Bill Clinton was like in fourth in the primaries in the Democratic Party and eventually in third in the general election, which would have been an impressive feat. And there was a guy named Muskie who was supposed to win and he cried in an event and, you know, he was gone. And, you know, there's a guy named LBJ who was supposed to run for another term and then he backed out. And these are just sort of historical presidential stories. I think if anybody had said a year ago, you know, there's a good chance that the Republican Party will likely lose their Senate race and their governor's race in Kansas, you know, I probably would have been laughed at. So you just don't know with this stuff. I mean, each of the last electoral cycles, the last three, I believe, no, two, pardon me, because of this vast sort of turnout operations that the Democrats have developed, and they spent like $60 million more this year. At least two to three races that were predicted to go for Republicans have gone Democratic, or states that were predicted to go Republican went for Obama. You know, I don't think it's ever happened in the other direction. So, you need to remember the polls are based on unlikely turnout models, and I think in some places that's going to be very accurate and we're going to lose. I think in other places it's more questionable whether we're going to lose. So,
all right, let's run down these. I mean, we've spoken in the past the implications of this shift in control of the Senate, but we know basically there are six Democratic seats up for re-election that or open, six formerly or currently held Democratic seats, we should say.
Yeah.
And the Republicans need to win at least six seats to take control of the Senate. Now, Montana and West Virginia, no chance. That's definitely going Republican. South Dakota is also looking like
We had a great run in South Dakota where we got close, and I would argue that had the DSCC and Harry Reid and people not had their heads up a certain place and not made this stuff personal and gotten behind Weiland a lot earlier, I think that that was a race where we would have had a great shot. But yep, it's not looking now. It's very high single digits, low double digits. It's not looking good right now. Even if there's a big turnout boost, you don't get that in turnout. So.
So we're at three. Arkansas, it looks like Pryor is not going to pull it out. Tom Cotton appears to be comfortably in the lead. But, well, you know, again, one never knows. But and then Louisiana is one of those places where people have been surprised in the past that it came out. At the very least, so it would be a surprise at this point if it goes to a runoff, and then it would be very tricky.
Well, that's why I think that's going to be too tough to win. I mean, I hope Landrieu has certainly, out of any of the six we're now talking about, I would say she has the best chance because she's proven herself a survivor before in other bad years. I think of 2002, which comes to mind, where she had to go to a runoff and she was behind and came in for like a last second victory. So and in 96, when I was actually doing some work at a shady polling firm, you may have heard of it, Penn and Schoen, just out of college, when Landrieu was one of the races that I was working on, and, you know, until they figured out who was voting, who was dead and alive 6 months later, she won by a very small margin. So she has, there's a history of that, but I think this time it may be too large a difference to pull out. And I would say the same thing with Alaska. It's looking that way, too.
Really? So Alaska is that final state. So that would be six.
Yes.
I think for some reason, I think that Begich is going to pull it out. But the polls do not bear that out. But I think Begich is going to pull it out. But be that as it may, let's say that those six go a Republican. Offsetting that would be the potential in Kansas. Now, Kansas, Orman is going to caucus with whoever wins. But that would offset.
The question is, if the Democrats have 49, so he could caucus with the Democrats and give them the Senate to the Biden tie-breaking vote at 50, does he do it then?
Right.
Or not? Because I think that's actually, you know, that's a very likely scenario. I think Orman's going to win, and there still has not been except for one crazy poll that showed Roberts up something like 4 or 5, which clearly was just junk. So Roberts has gotten a lot closer, but even in the most recent polls and in all of them, and, you know, Orman's up anywhere from 1 to 4 points. So I think he likely wins.
And then you have a potential pickup in Georgia, which I don't think anyone expected.
And that was trending in our direction for a bit.
Right.
It now seems to have, you know, with the outsourcing stuff, I really thought that might be a finishing touch to put them away. It seems like it hasn't. And I still think on Election Day, she's going to have a bigger vote than he does. The big problem there is that will also go to a runoff, which will not favor us. So we will have to turn a lot of the same people out during an even smaller, more, you know, sort of off the beaten path election.
Right.
And that's why I'm not so sanguine about that one. I think if it were just in this election that's happening in November, I think Michelle Nunn's going to have is going to come in with a lead, but I'm not sure she can hold that in a runoff. It reminds us of what happened in 2008, right, where the Democrat there is very close. I don't remember if he was a little bit ahead, a little bit behind Saxby Chambliss, but then the runoff a month later or whenever it was, he lost by about 15 points. You know, so that's what concerns me about that one. And I'm still sticking with my pick. You know, polls have been getting worse for for Grimes in Kentucky, but I talked to people on the ground there. I talked to a few really plugged-in people. I believe that the one or two that showed it 7 points or stuff, I don't believe that for a second. From what I've heard from internals, as well as the one they released by the Courier Journal poll, I had it at 5. I think that that's closer to reality. I think it's more like about 3 or 4 from what I hear, and I think it all comes down to whether the turnout can make up that 3 or 4. I put that race in the same class as where I put Iowa and Colorado, which is I think we win North Carolina and New Hampshire. Good old sexy hunky Scott Brown has made a good run of it, but I don't think he'll get there. And Shaheen, she still has a couple point lead. So I think to me the where this whole thing comes down to is Kansas, Kentucky, Colorado, Iowa. And my thoughts are that it's going to be all about turnout, and Orman's enough up ahead. There are Democrats in there, not as loudly, but silently turning people out for him. The most recent Iowa poll has it tied, or, you know, there was one that had Ernst up 1. I think the turnout wins it for Braley. Colorado, mail-in voting, which is huge, and that's the state where the biggest surprises have happened. I mean, of any state where Bennett wasn't supposed to win and won in 2010, he had never been shown ahead in one poll the entire race, was down to Ken Buck by 3-plus points and came back to win by about 2 or 3. And then Obama was only ahead 1 or 2 in the polling and won it by something like 6 points. So I think when you add in mail-in balloting, it's going to make it closer to a presidential election than an off year, and that Gardner is up somewhere around 2 to 3 points. I think Udall pulls that one out. So to me, it all comes down to whether McConnell's lead of what I think is about 3 to 4 points, whether they can overcome that with turnout. I'm going to say yes by a hair, but, you know, it's going to be really close. And if that were all to go the way I'm saying right now, the Democrats would have 51 seats and would yet again thwart the Republicans' attempt to take it over.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating. I mean, there are new Quinnipiac polls out, I guess, today in Iowa and in Colorado, showing that the races have basically tied, which is good news for the Democrats because they were both Braley and, like you say, Udall were trailing. It's hard to know. You know, it's one poll.
But a few polls have shown that recently, like in both of those. If they're not tied, they've shown either Ernst or Gardner barely up, certainly well within a margin that can be made up with a huge turnout. And that's what we've been hearing from some of the early turnout and mail-in voting that supposedly has been enormous. So really the only one I feel like, I'm really going out on a limb here. Not to say, look, you're always going on a limb when you're predicting stuff, but is Kentucky. I think it, you know, I think it's going to happen. And I think it's because they've been betting on turnout because they've known how tough beating McConnell is from the very beginning. They've been working that for a long time. I think she's gone to every corner of the state to places Democrats don't bother. So I think it's going to be close. But, if I were right, it's 51. But I could certainly see that, you know, if we're wrong about 2 or 3 of these races, it could end up with Democrats at 48. It's going to be somewhere in that range. You know, I think they're going to hold, but I think it's not going to be worth much because they haven't been able to do all that much with 55. So with 50 or 51, I don't see where that gets any easier.
The only difference is that it basically puts you in a better situation to stop things like the fast track authority, arguably. On TPP, it will ensure better judicial picks. It will also ensure more judges appointed to the federal bench. I mean, even the 51, 55, you just need to get to 51.
That's all true.
You're protecting some of the independent agencies like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in the event that they need an appointment because they need to function. They need a full complement of commissioners to function. I mean, that's why it is. I mean, yes, it is going to be you're going to see less than even what you've seen at this point, but the dam is still going to hold at 51. If not, then we're going to be talking on this program of, having to try and convince somehow President Obama not to go ahead with fast track authority and the TPP. We're going to see that happen. We're going to be talking about Supreme Court justices. We're going to be talking about hoping that President Obama vetoes this or vetoes that, and he's not vetoing that. I mean, there's going to be real implications if the Republicans take over the Senate that are not going to be
That's important. That's all very true. On the other side of things, the one thing I'd have to say, and don't get me wrong, because I certainly, because of all the reasons you just said, do not want the Republicans to come anywhere near having the keys to the Senate. But if they were to take it over, well, it will mean that a few of these crazy people we're talking about most likely will have gotten elected, like Joni Ernst or Cory Gardner, to join the Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Inhofe, you know, group of people that are just not sane. Yes,
well,
exactly.
You know, there was a really interesting piece that I read by, I think it was Norm Ornstein, who had talked about the narrative that was built this year in
the mainstream media.
And let me just explain the piece to people and I'll get your thoughts on it. But basically it was that the narrative that was built this year was that this was not going to be like 2012, where the Republicans, where the Tea Party base was able to nominate a couple of its own, and it thwarted the Republican chances to take over the Senate. And that the argument or the narrative this year was that the establishment has won out. Now, his piece makes sense if you perceive there actually to be an ideological difference between the Tea Party and the establishment. But it really just edifies what I've been saying, and I know that you've been saying, Cliff, which is the difference between the Tea Party and the establishment Republican Party is simply a question of media training. Because Joni Ernst and Cotton, and let you say Gardner, these are people who have been out there in the past talking about things like Agenda 21.
Right.
That the UN is attempting to take over our sovereignty and force us all to have, like, I don't know.
They're going to come take our
something.
Golf courses away.
Yes.
And they're going to be able to, through eminent domain, just take your land away for I don't know what, right?
Nullification. In other words, ignoring federal laws. Things like taking arms up against the federal government with the Second Amendment. And I think it was Ornstein did a check of compared like the Washington Post and the New York Times, and I've seen somebody else do one for the Iowa Register, I think, too. How many times Agenda 21 was ever raised?
No, I mean,
that's so important because
they're not doing, neither really the media nor Democrats are doing their jobs by not running against these people and simply pointing out what they are saying is crazy. And you let them say it enough in the mainstream, and then eventually it becomes accepted that that's okay. You know, these people shouldn't be able to go on Meet the Press and talk about issues one day where, you know, on Social Security and the economy and taxes and things like that as if they're rational human beings, when then they're going in big speeches saying, you know, we will not let people who try to come here and enforce federal law, if it's Obamacare, actually do their jobs. We'll kick them out of the state. Like, you can't, I mean, and that's where the media has failed, and it's where Democrats, frankly, have failed, too, because
right.
I would give Udall some points. At least he's pointed out again and again that Gardner's a liar and is a personhood nut. But, you know, and that is extreme and insane and would take away certain forms of birth control from women. But the rest of them haven't done that for the most part. They've run on issues, and that's good. But they haven't created, a whole narrative, which is what this person believes is not what rational people believe. And you can't send them there. And that, you know, and the media, again, has, as you just said, you know, Grimes says that she won't say whether she voted for Obama or not, which I personally think was dumb. But that becomes you're unqualified to be a senator. You're disqualified in the great Chuck Todd's words. But you're not disqualified if you believe Agenda 21 is a real thing.
Right. And,
I mean, that doesn't disqualify you from serving in our government.
Braley, apparently, like, the number of times that Braley's dispute with his neighbors about his chickens was mentioned like 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times, apparently, in the national media, and not once about Agenda 21. And you know, in this past week, it was released today, but it was actually last week that Tom Harkin had made these comments that Joni Ernst may, I keep hearing about how she looks good and she talks good, but, She may look like Taylor Swift and talk like Mr. Rogers, but, you know, her politics are really, it was a very inartful way of attempting to raise those things. And, you know, the Ernst campaign was smart. They sat on this for a week so that it was the final, in the final news cycle. But at the end of the day, this is a, you know, I mean, this is, I think, sort of also, it's an interesting lesson for people like you and I, frankly. And it's also, you know, I think there should be people, frankly, at MSNBC who are looking at this because they have been missing in action, as far as I can tell, on these midterms. And ostensibly, they're the sort of the mouthpiece of the Democratic Party. They're not even sort of, you know, there should have been a lot more Joni Ernst stories, I think. And because
yeah, and about
this is where the
position.
Media narrative plays into this, right? I mean, how does she get to not go to any editorial board meetings? How does the Iowa Register not tell the Iowan people that this is somebody who's literally, you know, would feel very comfortable on Glenn Beck's program, you know, at the chalkboard? And it's because that is strictly a media narrative battle.
Yeah, and that's the problem, you know, and you're right. I agree with you with MSNBC and some others because those are some of the few places that are, you know, mainstream enough that they can sort of break that narrative. If they were to have a constant stories on, I mean, you could have filled up 3 weeks, frankly, on crazy things that, you know, Joni Ernst or Cory Gardner or Tom Cotton have said. You know, you really could have very easily. And I think most people, hell, I couldn't. I know some of the things about Gardner and Ernst. I couldn't even tell you most of the crazy stuff Cotton has said. I mean, I haven't paid as close attention to that race because, A, I'm not a big Mark Pryor fan, and B, I've thought that that was one of the ones we were going to lose no matter what we did from the beginning. But I should know. I pay attention to this stuff.
Right.
It should have been so out there, you know, on the Huffington Post by people writing things in MSNBC and all sorts of places that I would know. And so, you know, that's a real problem because if regular mainstream media won't do their job, you know, and watch Joe Scarborough and any of his venues and you decide if they will do their job or not, then it takes people who are more partisan political operators and really not even partisan, but people that sort of believe in the truth to be out there because this can't be just part of the he said, she said. It can't just be, oh, well, you know, that person said that they didn't vote for Obama. That person believes the UN's coming in black helicopters to arrest you and execute you and take your land. These are not equivalent things. You know, these are John Birchers we're talking
right.
about here.
Right.
And we have to trust our government to them, the functioning of our government. And how's that been going for us lately? You know, and for the media to not do its job and point that out. So you're right. The only way to do that is to force them to. And if there are enough stories every day on places that other mainstream outlets pay attention to, the more objective media, let's call them, for lack of a better term, they would have to to cover it more. And the same with Gardner, because he, like Ernst, comes off as a nice guy, seems like a friendly guy. Oh, and by the way, he was the 10th most conservative person in the House. But hell, the Denver Post endorsed him. And maybe if he'd been, you know, as stupid and right-wing and idiotic as the Denver Post is, maybe if he'd been pointing out every day in different places other people had how the crazy things this guy believes, perhaps that doesn't happen. I don't know.
All right. Well, we only got about 5 minutes left here. I want to get your take on, you know, something that has been quite a dilemma for me. In New York State, and this is, you know, has no broader implication, but we can talk about, you know what, let's just touch before we get to Cuomo. You see something like that going on in Ohio, too, we should say, where John Kasich would have no public debate with his opponent for governor. Apparently, the only time they ever Ed Fitzgerald and his opponent and John Kasich ever sort of met face to face was in front of the in Ohio. Northeast Ohio Media Group, I guess.
It was basically with the Plain Dealer.
Editorial board.
Yep.
They released the video. It showed Kasich being really obnoxious, I guess, to Ed Fitzgerald.
And then they took it down. Like, literally not even acknowledging the guy was sitting in the room next to him. It basically was showing what's come out here and there when Kasich in the past had called a policeman who pulled him over an idiot one time. The guy is just, for lack of a better term, he's just a dick, which gets you places in the Republican Party these days, as we know. See Chris Christie, right? And they're now suing to try to maybe take this thing down because they endorsed him, of course. It just reminds you of how sad the whole situation is, quite frankly, because he's going to win with one of the biggest landslides ever here, because we nominated somebody for governor here from the Democratic Party who, it turns out, the vendors didn't think to look into the fact that he'd been driving without a driver's license for 10 years. And I mean, not to mention other things. I mean, the Ohio Democratic Party, literally, they should expunge every member and start a new, I mean, because Ohio is a swing state. And the number of times Republicans have won, have gerrymandered, have pulled things off here they should never be able to get away with in a 50-50 state such as this, it's embarrassing. And really, frankly, worse than that, we have the best lineup right now, one of the best lineups ever of down-ballot candidates. The guy I'm personally friendly with, who I think is terrific, David Pepper, running for the Attorney General against Mike DeWine. You may remember him, and some other terrific ones. And they're all probably going to lose. Because our at the top of the ticket, you know how that affects people down ballot, is going to lose by 30 points. Mm. It's a nightmare.
All right.
It's a nightmare.
Let's turn quickly to New York State. We got a couple minutes here. People know the story. The WFP contemplated running in the general election against Andrew Cuomo. They would have gone with Zephyr Teachout. They decided in the last minute they made a deal with Andrew Cuomo, wherein he would support Democrats running for New York Senate. It's hilarious to say that. And a couple of other measures. It turned out Zephyr Teachout went on to challenge Cuomo in the Democratic primary. She got 35% of the vote, surprising everyone. The Andrew Cuomo has since basically crapped all over the WFP. Developed another party called the WEP, which is ostensibly a women's
equality, voting, which, by the way, his guy's
party,
blocked.
Which almost, as far as I can tell, almost every female activist who they have claimed supports the party knows nothing about the party.
No, I mean, the whole point of the party is to take, because it looks close to WFP, right, to take votes away from them, because they need at least 50,000 people to vote on their ballot line, and they lose their ballot line.
Governor level, right.
Right, at the governor level, that's right. And the thing about that also is the things he promised to do, for example, endorsing certain Democrats, in places, which I know that's a huge, huge concession, to endorse people from your own party, against some of these independent, types and Republicans he likes. He's basically just put out a press release quietly saying he's endorsed him. He's basically done the least necessary. I know it puts you in a tough position. And I understand that the right thing for me to say to you that, you should vote for him on the Working Families Party line to make sure they keep their line. They've done a lot of great progressive things, and they have. But I'm sorry, I don't feel that I can lecture people and tell them to do that, because yeah, I find Cuomo so absolutely abhorrent. And I've got buddies at the WFP. I like them. They've done great work. But this was such a dumb move, and to me it was so transparently dumb at the time, because all you had to go on was Cuomo's promises, as if those mean fucking anything. And, I don't know what else to say, but they put themselves in this position by trusting this human being.
It comes down to, in my mind,
I would vote green.
I think the optimal amount of votes for the WFP to get is 50,001 votes. And I say that it's optimal because I don't believe that they're going to be able to in any way influence Andrew Cuomo. I want them to have their ballot line. They could actually, I think, pick it up by petition after the fact. But I also think that they need to be sent a message too, which is that
lay down with the dogs, you wake up with the fleas, to quote an old line.
And this is a message sent to the unions, and it really shows the limits on some level of their coalition, because the unions are really tied in, and maybe they can't run in gubernatorial politics. That can't be their field in which they have the most influence. But We'll talk more about that on this program later, but we got to say goodbye, Cliff. We got Becky Bond coming up next. She's going to tell us about the Credo Super PAC's efforts to get out the vote. But Cliff, say you and I will talk again on Friday, and maybe let's talk offline about what to do tomorrow night.
Okay, that sounds perfect.
All right,
thanks, man.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, folks. When we come back, we'll be talking to Becky Bond.
Forget what it was.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the president of the Credo Super PAC, Becky Bond. Hi, Becky.
Well, hey, Sam. It's great to be with you guys. As we are in the run-up to election, I'm so sick of hearing the pundits on television and on the radio and in the news, and it's so nice to be with a host and an audience, that are real progressives, people that are actually really fighting for what's right in this election. So I couldn't be happier to be here.
Yeah. All right. Well, tell me from your perspective, because we don't hear, so much of the implications, I think, of this midterm election are glossed over. I suppose theoretically we could say this at every election, but there are some real dangers, I think, here for progressives in particular if the Democrats lose the Senate. First off, fast track authority strikes me in terms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and its EU trade deal or cousin, I should say. But tell me some of the other issues that I think are relevant in the context of the Democrats losing the Senate in this midterm.
Oh, well, no questions. Elections matter. Even if you don't like the Democrats who are running, what happens matters, and it matters probably the progressives more than anyone else. We did see the New York Times, the story leaked from White House sources saying that the president is trying to figure out how he can compromise to cut deals on fast-track authority, on a trade deal, on the TPP. Other things that are almost certain to happen, McConnell has said that he'll use reconciliation to whack away at the Affordable Care Act piece by piece with only 51 votes. This is something that progressives urged the Democrats to do when passing health care reform, to use reconciliation and pass a strong bill, but Democrats wouldn't do it. And here McConnell is, a week out from the election saying, first things we're going to do is use reconciliation and start dismantling Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And we're also going to see, the president probably coming to the table with McConnell and others to cut the grand bargain on Social Security and Medicare. It's something that the president wanted to do before. It's something that Harry Reid and a Democratic Senate stopped him from doing thanks to activism from not just progressives, but the majority of Americans who don't want to see those programs cut. But we're likely to see them go to the table and the president to get the deal that he always wanted without Harry Reid in the Senate as the as the firewall. We're also likely to see the Republicans basically stop every single executive or judicial appointment for the rest of President Obama's term. And that means that these lifetime appointments that we need on the federal judiciary, these lifetime appointments will have people ruling on state issues like the 6-week abortion bans, like voting rights cases. We need progressive pro-Constitution judges in those lifetime appointments, because for the next generation, the attacks that are coming at the state level on women, on people of color, on voting rights, on corporations fighting for the right to pollute, that's our front line of defense of these federal judges. And Republicans are going to do everything they can to block any nomination that's progressive at all coming from the White House.
And so, all right, so give us a sense. I mean, you know, we've spoken on this program, obviously, about how the issue for Democrats across the country is really one of turnout. I mean, if we saw 2012 turnout levels, we wouldn't even be there'd be not a lot to talk about, frankly. But we're obviously not going to see that because it's not a presidential election. There are structural differences in the Republican and Democratic parties, whereby we see off-year elections just do not garner the same level of voter participation, or there's a drop. The drop-off is, I should say, more extreme on the Democratic side than it is on the Republican side. What are you guys doing, and what races are you targeting?
So that's a great question. In a midterm election, it really does come out to progressive-based turnout. And when we have an unpopular president who's even unpopular with a lot of Democrats right now, who hasn't delivered for key constituents, he hasn't delivered on climate, he hasn't delivered on immigration reform, he has largely not delivered on the economic and jobs agenda, a lot of our progressive-based voters, they don't necessarily see a strong reason to go out and vote, even though it's important. And so what we have to do is we actually have to go door-to-door and visit those voters who vote in presidential years who are not likely to turn out this year, and we have to tell them it's important to vote and get them to the polls. And that's what Creda Super PAC's been working on since June. We're in North Carolina, we're in Colorado, we're in Kentucky, we're in Michigan, we've been working on the Georgia race, and what we've been doing is going door-to-door, recruiting volunteers and going door-to-door and talking to these progressive drop-off voters to get them to the polls. We've also had local people phone banking since the summer. Right now, and we're in GOTV right now, and there's heavy calling and door knocking. We've just knocked on about 65,000 doors with local people who are like the voters that they are talking to. Local people on the phones talking to people having, you know, really quality conversations to make sure that they know it's important to get out to the polls. And, you know, if the party committees and the campaigns, you know, spent half the money they're spending on negative television advertising, which doesn't move voters to the polls, if they spent half that money on field, on the ground game, you know, we wouldn't be seeing these news reports, you know, saying Republicans are poised to take the Senate. We wouldn't lose the Senate if we spent money on mobilization. And so there's the issue of this isn't a presidential year, and, you know, progressive-based voters, they're not as consistent voters as other folks, but we have to look at other things. In a presidential year, you know, we saw this president run two amazing campaigns where he had volunteers going door to door turning out voters. And we don't have that in this midterm election, because that's not the kind of campaigns that the party committees have elected to run. And so that's what Creda Super PAC is doing on the ground in some key states, building infrastructure, getting local people involved in these races. And if these races are close, our work, you know, will be part of having made the difference.
I mean, there's actual. This is not, we should just say, this is not conjecture. I mean, there's been a lot of research, particularly as of late, which shows what motivates a voter to get to the poll if they're on the fence. And it is, in fact, that face-to-face encounter is far more effective than anything else. And I remember, you know, we spoke at Netroots Nation in Detroit, I guess it was in July, and you had just come back from meeting with some local people who were manning that field operation. So let's start with, why do you think, I mean, it seems somewhat obvious to me, but it may not be to our audience. Why do you think that more money is spent on those negative ads than, say, building an infrastructure where you have local people going out and talking to other local people and getting them to vote?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few answers to that question, and it's so frustrating because, like you said, there's a growing body of evidence that shows, yeah, there's no more effective way to run a campaign than to have local people going door-to-door talking to voters and urging them to vote. And especially in a midterm election when turnout is low, there's a small number of persuadable people out there, but what you really need to do is just find the people that already agree with you and make sure they vote, right? That's a much easier thing to do than actually persuade people that are on the fence, and it also... We as progressives, you know, when you're going after the persuadable vote, you're making compromises to appeal to people that don't share your values in order to get them to vote. And we can have much more progressive majorities if we actually could move the people that agree with us to vote more often. And, you know, I think there's a few things that are happening. I think that, for one thing, if you want to build this volunteer field operation in the states, you have to pick your races and start working on it. You know, we picked our races in April, and we were on the ground with offices opening in June. And that's before most national groups ever decide what races that they want to work on. And so you have to make choices, and you have to invest early because it takes time to build these operations.
Why don't they do that? Is it because they're not gearing towards actually the ideology of those people? I mean, why are you guys able to do that and other organizations are not?
You know, there's a few things. One is it's just a lot of work to manage these operations with a lot of people. It's much easier to run a bank account and wire money into advertising agencies' accounts and run ads. Like, you know, you can have two people in D.C. in a bank account and run that kind of campaign. From this kind of campaign, you have to hire, you know, dozens and dozens of people and manage them and start early. And I think a lot of groups, they only want to work in the closest contests. And we don't know for sure what the closest contests are until, you know, after... September or October, really. And so you have to be willing to make a bet and get into it. And I think another huge problem is that, you know, so much political work at the national level is done by consultants, and consultants don't get a percentage of volunteer field organizing. They simply don't, right? They just don't. People in D.C. don't make money off of running field operations. What they make money off of is selling advertising. They get a percentage of the media buy. They have a media production firm on the side that they're a partner in. And so the problem is the consultants get paid win or lose, and the consultants get paid a lot of money when they're involved in advertising heavy campaigns. And your average donor is just not, you know, to be honest, your average donor is just not necessarily educated about the science and about the evidence that shows, you know, what has a greater return. And I think campaigns really do a disservice, not just to voters and to progressive ideals, but also to their donors by misspending their money and losing races. And I think we need to change something about the economics and the system of rewards where people make money whether they win or lose by running these big advertising campaigns.
That dynamic with consultants, we should say, seems to stretch across many, many different industries, and maybe not coincidentally. But all right, so let's talk about specifically the races that you are engaged in: Kentucky, Colorado, North Carolina, Michigan, and Georgia. What are you hearing from the folks who are working on the ground? And I guess, you know, I know that it must be tough if they're in this sort of bubble where they're only talking to voters who they think are already, you know, willing to vote for the Democratic candidate, just not necessarily willing to actually vote. It's tough to necessarily get a sense from them. But I'm curious, like in a place like Kentucky, in Colorado in particular, what are the people who are on the ground saying to you?
Well, so I was just in Kentucky, and I was knocking on doors, talking to voters, you know, who are at risk of not turning out, and making sure they knew where their polling place was, making sure they knew how they were going to get to the polls. And you know, overwhelmingly, what we're hearing on the ground in a place like Kentucky is that the people who want McConnell out have a lot more passion than the people who want to keep McConnell in. And, you know, even the Credo Super PAC volunteers in Louisville, they're getting robocalled by the McConnell campaign. Now think about what a waste that is, like for McConnell to be robocalling not just Democrats, but progressive activists, right, in that campaign. And that's the kind of campaign he's running. Meanwhile, we've got all these activists who are actually out there every day talking to voters that they can see on their sheet of paper that they voted in 2008 and voted in 2012, but didn't vote in 2010. And they're doing, you know, what it takes to explain to those folks that the race is close. I mean, in a race like Kentucky, and we've seen this in other races where you have an incumbent who, you know, he's been reelected with wide margins in his recent elections, but it's really because no one mounted a serious campaign against him. So what you have with the Grimes campaign is the first time Democratic voters have had to actually think that their vote would matter in a race that's really close. And the people on the ground, they say they don't trust the polls. They're actually quite sophisticated. They say they think a lot of people are going to vote that the pollsters aren't counting. They think a lot of people are motivated by the fact that this is the first time that McConnell's really in danger. I talked to voters that I could see had voted in 2008 and 2012, but not 2010. And I talked to them and said, not only am I voting, but all six people in our household are voting. We're going to the polls together. We're going to go at 6:30 in the morning. I talked to a woman who was 85 years old, and she had not voted in 2012, but she'd voted in the last three elections. And I asked her why she had not made it to the polls in 2012. And she said, well, I went, but the line was too long, and I couldn't stand that long, so I went home. And I said, well, what are you going to do this year? And she said, I'm going to, the polling place opens at 6, and I'm going to go at 6, because there's not going to be a line there, and I'm going to make sure that my vote gets counted. So you know, it's hard to say in any of these contests, you know, they're really close, and we know that in 2006 and in 2010, in toss-up Senate races, Democratic performance was undercounted by about 4 points. And so, you know, if these races are within 3 points, based on the polls, and Democrats are being undercounted by 3 or 4 points in terms of their performance, then, you know, we'll see some upsets. But again, it's too close to call, and it's all going to come down to the ground game. And I would say if we lose the Senate, I think we shouldn't blame voter apathy. I think we should blame a Democratic establishment that spent hundreds of millions of dollars on television advertising instead of building the neighbor-to-neighbor field campaigns that were built to elect the president in 2008 and 2012, the kind of campaign that's being run by Mark Buttigieg in Alaska, the kind of campaigns that I think is going to save Mark Udall in Colorado. We need to see the Democratic establishment spend monies in ways that doesn't let down Democratic voters and progressive activists.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is also getting to the donor class and basically educating them, right, and requiring them to have a greater, I guess, demand a greater level of accountability in terms of where their money goes. So your sense is in Colorado, too, that Udall has a good chance?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, we saw this with Bennett. I mean, in 2010, everybody, all the polls pointed to the fact that he was going to lose. It was because the polls weren't counting a lot of the voters that were being mobilized by the door-to-door canvasses. And Colorado, because it's been a contentious presidential state, you know, activists in Colorado understand that what you need to do is go door-to-door and talk to voters. And so when you ask them to do that, they know how to do it. They know it's important that they're out there. So there's a lot more people knocking on doors for the Mark Udall campaign than there are for the Grimes campaign or for the Hagan campaign. And so I think where we see a bigger ground game, then Democrats are more likely to win. I think it's that simple.
And finally, let me ask you about Georgia, because Georgia, it seems to me, has been sort of a sleeper throughout this race. Very underreported, I think, is sort of the organizing that's gone around their own Moral Mondays in Georgia. I mean, people talk about Moral Mondays happening in North Carolina, but it's been significant organizing in Georgia as well. Give me a sense of what you're hearing from your folks on the ground there.
You know, I think Georgia is a really tough one. I think this is, to be totally honest, this is really David Perdue's race to lose. I think Georgian activists are, they're always asked to go to Florida and help win, you know, other races. And finally, they have a race of national importance in their own backyard with the Senate race. And it's really been Perdue telling the truth about his support for outsourcing and proud of being an outsourcer. And, of course, he closed down plants all the time and making those statements that are making, you know, Georgians, black and white Georgians, wake up and say, well, this is not someone who's going to care about our record jobless rates here in Georgia. And, you know, it's going to be a really tough race to win in part because if this race doesn't, if Michelle Nunn doesn't get 50%, right, then it's going to go into a runoff, which will be very difficult. Will be very difficult to win. And this is a seat we should have won in 2008 outright, when Saxby Chambliss was able to pull it out over Jim Martin. And what we're seeing in Georgia, I think, is if the Democratic establishment had really invested in a ground game, but we also have an election system that's rigged against low-income and minority voters. There's 40,000 voter registration cards that were collected by an amazing group called the New Georgia Project that the Secretary of State's office is holding hostage. And those people aren't going to be able to vote. Not only will they not be able to vote, but if you're not registered for the general, you can't vote in the runoff. So we see a rigged system, but we see a Democratic candidate doing really well just because Republicans are revealing themselves for what they really are, which is, you know, corporate tools that don't actually care about everyday Georgians. And even in a conservative state like Georgia, voters are starting to wake up. The question is, will they have enough time?
How are they going to get away with that 40,000 registrations? I don't understand that. I've been trying to follow that story. It just seems crazy to me.
Yeah, and you know, in a after the Supreme Court, you know, gutted the Voting Rights Act, it's hard to say how, you know, we can, you know, federally intervene in these cases where this happens to the state. And, you know, the deal is it's going to have to be fought out in the courts, and that's not going to happen until after the election, and then it's too late.
All right. Well, Becky, is there any way, we're participating in a call out the vote program this week, but is there any way that folks want to get involved in what Credo is doing, the Super PAC? What can they do?
Oh, my gosh. Well, especially if you're in, you know, Kentucky or Colorado or North Carolina, you should go to credosuperpac.com and look up your local office. We would love to have you come down, and any listeners who are in state, and join with, you know, with your neighbors and being part of a massive and progressive get out the vote effort. So check out credosuperpac.com if you're one of our five states, and we will put you to work in person with local progressive neighbors who are doing amazing work. And it's great that your national listeners are participating in these out-of-state efforts. We're really focusing our efforts on in-state folks talking to in-state voters, because that's the most effective way to get them to the polls. So we'll take the local volunteers, and it's amazing. Everyone else is calling in from out-of-state. Thank you for that.
Becky Bond, president of Credo Super PAC, thanks so much for joining us and for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, just a reminder, this program relies on its members for 99.5% of its revenue. If you can afford to become a member, please become a member today. It allows us to do the daily show. It's going to allow us to, maybe buy, I think, the drum separators, the drum shields. Yes, we're going to put up some drum shields, apparently. We don't have any drums, but we're going to use that to sort of create a couple of different separate sound areas. And we're going to get some egg crate. What are those called? Waffle boards. We're going to get all that stuff. And, of course, we're going to get this. I'm trying to think of what the sound guy told me to get tomorrow. I mean, I haven't.
We need stuff for sound, folks. That's pretty much all you got to say.
I've written it down. Wait a second. It is not the Black Magic.
We need a waffle maker. Switcher. That's what Sam wants to say.
If there was any chance that we could get a waffle maker, that would be great. We're getting a Octopre Mic 2 dynamic microphone.
Is my mic even on? Can you hear me through this?
Yeah.
Yeah. You sure? All right, I guess you can.
Well, you should be checking the levels.
Well, the audio in this room doesn't make it so easy.
Turn up. No, you should be checking the levels by looking at the levels. You should turn it up a little bit. I can see it on the Nicecast. One of the things we're going to get is a manual
check, one,
how
two.
To do audio
check.
For dummies.
Oh.
For Matt. But if you can become a member today, please do, by all means. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com, MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through there. We get a little kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. great coffee, great company, great fair wages all the way down the line. You will not regret trying Just Coffee even once, ladies and gentlemen. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. We will take your phone calls and your IMs, of course, at via the app at majorityapp.com. The iOS app completely updated now. Streaming should be a breeze, and IMing should be no problem. I'm going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment.